Hey there, foreigners. This is Rohit from BreakingTheBorders.com, home of the ambitious immigrants. A few weeks ago, I sent a request asking for what is the biggest question that you have. And I got a lot of responses. And one of the biggest one was, what visa classes are applicable for entrepreneurs? So I invited Sara Constant, who is a startup immigration attorney, to go through all the visa classes that are applicable. I'm so excited to have you today, Sara. Sara, welcome to Breaking the Borders podcast.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
So, Sara, before we go into the details of the visa options and things like that, can you tell us a little bit about yourself? How did you get yourself into immigration and startup immigration in particular?
Sure. Well, I grew up in a very entrepreneurial family. My dad started a company when I was younger, and I grew up working, you know, in our basement and then in his first office. And I worked in the family business throughout my childhood. And so I always had that sort of entrepreneurial spirit and desire to start my own business when I became an attorney. And I also just loved to travel, and immigration law appealed to me. So I thought doing immigration for startups is a good way to...
How is that connected? How is the travel and immigration law connected? I'm curious to know.
I guess meeting people from, you know, meeting people abroad who then I would meet later in the U.S. and hearing about what they had to go through to get visas. And it just exposed me to what people have to go through to be able to visit the U.S., whereas I'm able to travel pretty freely as an American. If I want to take a vacation somewhere, I don't have to, you know, go through a lot of the rigmarole that a lot of people who need to come here do.
Yeah, absolutely. There is a automatic 30-day visa for most countries, right, which is very helpful. So you travel a lot, is it? What is the one unlikely place that you have been to while you're traveling?
Oh, well, probably the most unlikely place is Yemen. I spent a year in Yemen after
college. Oh, you spent a year?
Yeah.
Oh, that's nice.
There aren't many people who have traveled to Yemen.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Okay, so we can jump right in. Before we start, do you want to state anything about what we are going to discuss?
I guess it's just important to keep in mind that every immigration situation is very different. So today we're going to go over some very high-level, basic, general information. But before you make a decision on your own case, you should definitely consult with someone one-on-one.
Yeah. That's a good point. Okay, let's start with the first one. We exchanged some notes before we started. The first one I have up here is OPT, right? So what is OPT?
So OPT is it's a work authorization for students, for F1 students. And it's a very flexible work authorization. The limitation is that it has to be in your field of study. But other than that, you don't have to be paid a specific wage. You can start your own company. It's very flexible in all other respects. So it's a great option for student entrepreneurs who have just graduated and are starting a business in their field of study. You get 12 months of OPT for every educational level that you complete in the U.S. And if you're a STEM graduate, at the moment, you can get an additional 17 months of OPT on top of the 12 months that everyone gets, for a total of 29 months. So at the moment, the STEM extension, it's been in court, and it's set to be suspended, or set to be voided in February 2016 if they don't, because there were some procedural problems with the way that the STEM extension was issued last time. Hopefully before February comes around, they will reissue it properly and do the notice and comment that they failed to do the first time, and it'll be extended without having any ill effects on people who are currently on STEM extension or applying for STEM extension. But it is something to keep in mind.
Yeah. So I graduated with a master's degree, and I had an OPT as well. But at that time, I did not know that was something that you can start a business with. So that's great to keep in mind. And one of the past guests, Shyam Devnani, who started a company called India in a Box, being on OPT, you can check out his interview at breakingtheborders.com/Shyam. Shyam, but he is doing it. He's in the first year, I believe.
Yeah, it's a great status for entrepreneurs to start out on because you don't have to prove a lot of the things that you have to prove in terms of funding and operations that you do for some of the other statuses. So I have quite a few clients who start their businesses on OPT. They'll use that time to pitch to investors and try and ramp up operations as much as they can. And then hopefully by the end of the OPT time, they're ready to be able to have the company sponsor them for an H1B or an E2 or something like that.
Okay, so that brings us to the next one, B1 and visa waiver. So B1 is a visitor visa, right? Like when my parents were visiting me, they were on B1 visa. We can also start a company with that. How does it work?
You can, yeah. So this is another good option for people who don't have OPT. You can do a lot of startup activities on a B1 visa or a visa waiver. It's limited to preliminary stage activities. So you can do things like market research, you can incorporate your company, set up a bank account, you can pitch to funders, but you can't actually do any work on the product. So, if it's a software company, you can't be writing code while you're in the US on a B1. But you can do more general
So
business
I
development
can
activities.
pitch to investors on a B1?
Yes, you
Okay.
can. You can seek out funding, you can sign contracts with your investors, you can sign contracts with vendors or potential clients. All of those things you can do on a B1 or the visa waiver program. The visa waiver is basically almost exactly like a B1, but it's limited to people from certain countries and it's
What are
limited
the
to 90
countries?
days.
Is it a big list or is it a small list
It's
that we?
a very long list.
Oh, it's a
You
very long
should
list. Okay.
Google it. Yeah, it's
Okay.
a long list of a different countries. Lots of European countries and
Okay.
Australia
So what
and
can we Google for to find out the list?
visa. I would just Google visa waiver program,
Okay.
countries list, something like that, and it'll come up on Department of State.
Okay.
But there's some drawbacks to it. So a lot of my clients who are eligible for a visa waiver program, it ends up that I suggest to them they go ahead and apply for a B1 anyway and go through the process of getting it at the consulate because with the visa waiver program, it's only good for 90 days and you can't extend. A B visa, it's good for 6 months and you can extend if you need more time at the end of that. And also, sometimes the biggest problem is that you can't change status from the visa waiver program. So if you're coming over, let's say you're wanting to start a company on an E2 visa and you're coming over on B1 on B1 or the visa waiver program to kind of get things started, set up the company, make your initial investment. If you're on a B1, you could change status without leaving the country. If you're on the visa waiver program, you would have to leave the country before you can change status. So
I see.
it's also a good option for incubators, accelerators. You have to be really careful what you're doing at the accelerator, but if you are limiting your activities at the accelerator to things like meeting with mentors or pitching to investors, things like that, those are all things you can do on a B1. So you just have to know at the outset that you can't do a lot of substantive work on the product. But if you're a founder who's working more on the business side of things anyway, the B1 can be an option that'll allow you to come and participate in an incubator and accelerator.
I see. So can we get paid on this visa?
You can't be getting paid by a legal entity.
Okay.
Or by a US company on the B1 visa. You can, in certain circumstances, get reimbursed for incidental expenses of your travel, but the test for if something is an admissible activity on the B1 is whether or not it's work. You can't do work on the B1. And if you're getting paid to do something, that's a pretty good indication that that's work. So,
Yeah.
no.
So the next one I have is H1B.
All right, H1B. H1B, the most common type of visa for professionals,
Yeah.
software developers,
I'm on
anything that
H1B
is.
right
You're on
now.
H1B? Yeah, so
Yes.
you know all about it.
Yeah.
It's a good visa for professionals. It's for employees with a specialized degree who have been offered a position in a specialty occupation. And specialty occupation is something that requires a specific degree. So it's not enough for a job to require a college degree. It has to require specifically a degree in computer science or biology or whatever. So that's one limitation. Another requirement of the H-1B is that the company has to pay you the prevailing wage for whatever your job is. And the wages vary widely by geographic location and profession. So if you're a software engineer in New York City or San Francisco, the wage that the company's required to pay is going to be a lot higher than if you were a software engineer in rural Nebraska. Mm-hmm. So it's really hard to say what the wage is going to be before you know where the person is. Also, they are very literal about wage. So you have to be paid that wage in cash.
So equity doesn't count is what you're saying. Okay.
Not towards the wage. You can get equity as part of your compensation package, but it's not going to help you out meeting the wage.
I see. So it is on H1, like how I'm working now, it's with a company, right? But if I want to start my own company, how am I the employee?
It can get really, really difficult if you are a part owner of the company. Because another one of the requirements for H-1B is that you have an employer-employee relationship, which means that the company has to have the power to hire you, fire you, control your work, set your wage. And as you approach, 50% ownership, it becomes harder and harder to convince USCIS that the company that you don't have enough influence in the company to prevent yourself from getting fired, basically, if you don't want to be fired. So the closer you get to 50%, the more justification you have to present to USCIS to show them exactly what the process for reviewing your performance is, who has the power to fire you, who's controlling your work, what does the oversight process look like.
Okay, so it is still an employee-employer relationship like right. I have right now with my employer, but just that you have an equity as well as a percentage.
Right.
Like I own currently my company stock, but it is 0.0001% or something,
yeah.
Right? But if I have my own company, that's going to be a double-digit number. So mm-hmm. is it? So you're saying that is 50% the maximum limit that you can go to?
I mean, theoretically, you can go over 50% if you have set up the company in such a way that you've removed a lot of your own control, which a lot of founders are understandably not willing to do. You would have to set up a board that's so independent of you that they could theoretically fire you from your position in the employee, from your employee position in the company.
What do you mean by an independent board?
If you have a board of directors of the company
that has
the power to hire and fire employees, including yourself.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with that is usually then the owner has the ability to change the board. So if they fired him, sure, they can fire him, but then he can come back in and replace them with a new board that's more favorable to himself. So you have to come up with a way with your business attorney to remove your power to control the company, basically, which is very difficult to do in a convincing way. And most people aren't willing to do it. So
yeah.
The H-1B is best for people who have a minority stake in the company. It's possible to try with a majority stake, but it's very, very difficult.
I see. So it's recommended to be below 50%. And how about a case where I already have an H-1 with my current company, mm-hmm. and I also have a business idea that I want to work on in my evenings or later on the weekends. So what can I do in that case?
Well, you're in a really good position in that case because you already have an H-1B. So you can, you shouldn't be working for your company. You shouldn't be developing the company on the side without authorization. But your company can file for a concurrent H-1B for you. So you can have a lot of people don't know this, you can have as many H-1Bs for as many different companies as you want at the same time. You just have to file a concurrent H-1B petition. So you can keep your full-time job and file a part-time H-1B. through your company?
Through my own company, which I'm doing on the side. So does my original company, which sponsored my H1, has to do something also?
They don't. You file a concurrent petition, and your original company doesn't. It doesn't change your relationship with your original company.
I see. And is there any limit on the number of hours that I can work in this?
There's not. There's no limit written into the regulations.
I see. So yeah, that's a good way. But one of the things that I hear a lot of friends go through right now, people who are just graduating and finish their OPT and applying for H1, is that they just don't get in, right?
Yeah. Right now the cap is, and it looks like it's going to be that way this year and for the foreseeable future.
What is the cap? Can you give a brief explanation?
So the cap is every year, the number of H-1Bs available is limited to 85,000 new H-1Bs. That includes 65,000 for people with bachelor's degrees or the equivalent. Of that 65,000, 5,400 are reserved for H-1B1s for people from Chile or Singapore. And the remaining 59,600 is available for the general pool. Then there is a 20,000 master's cap. So they have set aside 20,000 special H-1Bs for people who have master's degrees from an accredited U.S. university. So if you've got a master's degree from a U.S. university, you're in a much better position because you get two shots at getting an H-1B. You put in your master's cap petition. You get a shot at being selected for one of the $20,000 master's cap positions. If you don't get that in, if you don't get one there, they throw your petition in the general cap, and you get another chance at being randomly selected in the general cap. So your odds go up.
I see. You have two shots at it.
Yeah. But if you don't, it's for a lot of people, which it's more than half at this point, significantly more than half, won't get selected. They're required to keep accepting petitions for the first 5 days of the fiscal year. For the first 5 days of when the cap opens, which is in April, 6 months before the fiscal year starts. So they will accept every petition they receive in the first five business days, and then they will select the number that they need to fill that 85,000 cap. And the rest of them, it's so sad, they just send them back. Just send back the entire petition. So you've done all that work, you've presented a complete petition, and they just send it back to you. They don't even look at it. They don't get to the merits of the decision. Yeah, a lot of people confuse the cap with the merits decision. So getting through the cap just means that they're going to look at your petition and decide if you should get an H-1B. So the people who don't make it through the cap, they don't even look at the petition. The people who make it through the cap have still got to prove that they qualify on the merits of the application.
Okay. And the last point I have here on H-1B is about nonprofit research. What is that?
So a way to avoid the cap, certain employers are exempt from the cap. So certain nonprofit research institutions or educational institutions can apply for an H-1B at whatever time of the year they want, and their employees aren't subject to the cap. So one way to, if you've applied through the cap and you haven't gotten in, a workaround can be if you have an offer at a nonprofit research institution or educational institution.
What is an example of a nonprofit research or educational institution?
Like something doing, an institution doing medical research or a wing of a university dedicated to research. It's about, it's specifically, not just any nonprofit will qualify. You have to be a nonprofit devoted to researching. You can get a job offer from a nonprofit research institution. You can then stack your H-1B that you didn't get through the cap on top of that nonprofit H-1B. So let's say you get a part-time job doing research at a, you know, biomedical research at a cancer research institution, and you're doing that for 15 hours a week. You can then apply for a concurrent H-1B, like we were talking about earlier, to work at your at the startup company that failed to get you in through the cap. So as long as you are working for that nonprofit research institution, you're allowed to stack a for-profit H-1B on top of that. But the moment you lose your job at the nonprofit, you also lose your ability to keep working at that at the for-profit startup without filing a cap subject H-1B. But for some people who have who are in certain, you know, technical fields, it's realistic for them to get an offer and be able to do both at the same time. So
yeah, that seems like a good way to get around the cap, definitely. And I didn't know about this before. And one of the other things that you mentioned, I was consulting also with you to talk about whether podcasting and all is okay to do, right? And one of the things that you mentioned is, apart from immigration laws, another thing that you have to consider while on H-1 is the employment contract. Mm-hmm. Right? Do you want to quickly touch on that?
The employment contract,
I was saying that, like, if even if for concurrent H-1 or anything, even mm-hmm. if the immigration allows you, you still have to look at your employment contract, right?
Yeah. Right. I'm not an employment lawyer, so I don't know all of the ins and outs of what you can and can't do. But you do need to be aware, if you are working for one H-1B employer and they have something, a clause that prevents you from working for someone else while you're working for them, then just because you can get an H-1B to do it doesn't mean that you can ignore the terms of that you're bound to under the employment law.
Yeah. Great. So I know that H-1s are not for people from all countries, right? So I think like Mexicans, Canadians, Australians, they have a separate alternative to this. So what can you talk about that?
Yes. So anyone from any nationality can apply for an H-1B. But as we were talking about, your odds of getting an H-1B are getting lower and lower the more people are applying in April for the cap. So people from certain countries have some pretty good alternatives that are quite similar to the H-1B, but have no cap. Like the H-1B. So one of those, so the TN is available for Mexicans and Canadians. It's a similar type of visa in that it's available for people who are members of the professions. So for jobs that require a specialized degree, it's a little less flexible because the TN visa has a specific list of approved professions under NAFTA. And if you don't fit into one of those on the list, then you can't get a TN. But there are quite a few, like engineers are on the list. So software engineers qualify under the engineering category. But if you have a job that's not on the list, then you're out of luck.
So is it based on the country of citizenship or country of birth?
For the TN, it's based on the country of citizenship.
I see.
So you could be born anywhere, and if you have Canadian citizenship, you qualify. It has to be citizenship, though. A permanent resident won't qualify for a TN.
Okay.
It's a great alternative for the H-1B for newer companies as well as being able to get around the cap. It's just a lot cheaper. The filing fee is $50 as opposed to over $1,500 for most companies. And there's no prevailing wage requirement. So you can pay a lower wage as long as it's enough to live on. Also, it's renewable indefinitely. So there's no six-year limit.
That is one thing that we didn't talk about on the H-1 category.
Right. The H-1 is limited to 6 years maximum. And that clock is running anytime that you are in the U.S. on H-1B status. So if you take a vacation for 2 weeks, while you're on H-1B and you go to Canada or India or wherever, though your clock stops. But as soon as you come back in the U.S. on H-1B status, it starts again.
So that gap is not there for TN, is it?
It's not. But TN, unlike the H-1B, requires that you prove non-immigrant intent. So you have to show that your real life, you know, your real home remains in Canada or Mexico, and you're coming to the U.S. only temporarily to work. And the longer you've been here working on a TN, the harder it gets to prove that your real home is Canada or Mexico, and you're just here temporarily. You know, if you've been here 10 years with the same company and you show no sign of leaving, you're the risk that at the border they're going to start questioning your intent to stay here permanently rises.
I see. And how often do you have to renew this visa?
The visa, the TN can be granted for up to 3 years at a time.
Okay. Okay, so on to the next one, H-1B1 for Singapore and Chile.
Right. So that is basically people from Singapore and Chile have a special pool of H-1Bs that are reserved for them, and they're called H-1B1s. They are almost identical to H-1Bs in every respect, except the cap hardly ever gets filled. So even though there is a cap, you never have to worry about it because it's never filled. And the H-1B1 is not a dual intent visa. So H-1B1 holders have to prove that they have non-immigrant intent, that they're not coming, that they're coming only temporarily. The E-3 is a similar, it's almost exactly the same as the H-1B, but it's specifically for Australians. And it's also not dual intent. But there's no cap on the E-3. So it's a great option for Australians to avoid the cap.
And is there a limit on extending the E3?
There is. I'm blanking out. I don't think there is, but I'm not 100% sure. I'd have to double check that.
Okay. The next one I have on your list is L1.
All right. L1 is an option for people who have been working for a company abroad for at least a year. So this is a really good viable option for entrepreneurs who have started a successful company outside of the U.S. and are looking to expand into the U.S. You have to prove that there will be two companies, one inside the U.S. and one outside the U.S., and that they have a qualifying relationship. So they can be parent subsidiary, they can be owned by the same person, or a group of people, or they can be subsidiaries of the same company. Any one of these relationships will satisfy the L1 criteria. So a lot of times I'll have an entrepreneur who has started a company that he majority owns in Pakistan, and now he wants to set up a branch in the US. And he'll incorporate here, and he'll also be majority owner here. So that qualifies for L1 because it's owned by the same person.
I see. So you can't be working for one startup, let's say in Pakistan, and come here on another startup on L1. It has to be the same or related.
It has to be related in one of those ways. Okay. So they don't have to be the same company doing the same thing. Okay. You could start a completely different type of company. But as long as it is, you know, has a parent subsidiary relationship with the first company or is owned by the same person, it will qualify.
Got it. All right. Okay.
You do have to show that you've been employed for 1 year abroad by the company in a managerial, executive, or specialized knowledge capacity.
What does specialized knowledge mean?
Specialized knowledge is that is the question. It's a very tricky category to get. You have to prove that you have a really, really special set of skills that are vital to this particular company. So it's not enough to show that you have a unique set of skills. You have to show that you have specialized knowledge about the company itself in a way that someone else with a specialized skill set coming in from outside of the company wouldn't have. It's one of the most notoriously difficult visa categories to qualify under, because USCIS takes a pretty strict interpretation of what counts as specialized knowledge. So if you are someone with specialized knowledge who is also a manager or executive, it's usually better to go the L1
So is it a different visa class for manager or executive versus the specialized knowledge worker?
It is. Manager executive is called L1A, mm-hmm. and L1A can be granted for up to 7 years. L1B is the class for the specialized knowledge employees, and it is valid for up to 5 years. So,
and yeah, these really, 5 or 7 years, do you get it for like blanket 7 years when you start out, or how does it?
No, it depends on how the stage that the company is at when you're first applying. If it's a new office, so if you're starting up a new company, if you're an entrepreneur and you're starting up a new company here in the US from scratch, it's called a new office L, and it's only granted for a year. And then at the end of the year, they will reevaluate how your company is developing. And if things are going well, they will start granting you in larger increments. It can be granted for up to 3 years at a time.
Okay, 3 years at a time. And running up to 7 for L1A and 5
right.
for B.
Right.
Got it.
And one thing to keep in mind is that the time you spend on the L1B counts towards the H1B clock and vice versa. So you can't do 7 years on L1 and then switch to H1B and get another 6 years. If you do 7 years on L1, you will have to leave the country for at least a year to reset your clock before you'll be eligible for any more L1 or H1 time.
So all the visa classes that we discussed so far, do you help individual clients with their situation go through any of these that we listed so far?
Yes, I do all of these. Basically,
I see.
Everything that we are talking about today,
yeah.
I have done. So it's just it just depends on the situation.
I see. And what is the best place to like actually get to know how much you charge and what you do with these and stuff like that?
I have all of my prices listed on my website, startupimmigrationattorney.com. So I have a fees page, so you can see I charge flat fees for all of these. So my fees are listed on my website. And in terms of what's involved in the process, I have a blog that has information about different steps of the different visas. But, you know, obviously if you need specific information on your case and which visa is best for you, it's best to do a consultation. I do free initial consultations briefly to kind of get an idea of what you're looking for and what type of visa might be best.
I see. Okay. Yeah, I'm on your startupimmigrationattorney.com website, and I see the fees for all visa classes, H1, O1, E1, L1, all the things that we discussed and we are going to discuss so far. And I haven't seen a page like this before, I must say, from any other attorney who states right off the bat. It's comforting to know, I must say.
Yeah.
Great. So all the notes also, along with the things that we discussed, will be on the show notes page, breakingtheborders.com/visa. I forgot to say that earlier, so I'm just including that here. So we can move on to the next one, Sarah, which is O-1 visa. This is an interesting one. I know someone who just been on H1 for 3 years and went to O-1 visa.
Yeah.
So I would love to know more about it. What is O-1 visa?
Well, the O-1 visa is a really great flexible visa for people who qualify. It can be renewed indefinitely, initially granted for 3 years, and then it can be renewed for as many years thereafter as you continue to qualify. It is for people of extraordinary ability in sciences, business, education, athletic, arts, or motion picture industry. And the standards for each of those is different. So if you are trying to prove that you are of extraordinary ability in science or business, the standard is really, really high. You have to show them that you are really in the top small fraction of your field. If there's something artistic about what you do, like if you're a graphic designer or really anything that has a hint of anything artistic about it, you might want to try to fit yourself into the arts category, because it really is pretty broad. And the standard is actually a lot lower. They both say extraordinary in the regulations, but the way it's been interpreted, extraordinary in the arts is a lot easier to meet than extraordinary in science or business.
Is interviewing an art?
Interviewing an art? I'm not sure about that.
Okay.
You try and come up with, I suppose you could say there's an art to it.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not an artsy guy at all, but so it was hard for me. I had to like flex my artsy muscles to actually do this that I'm doing with you, you know? So,
I mean, it's really, I mean, who knows? There might be a way that I've heard of bodyguards getting a one visas under the arts category, arguing that it is an, you know, being a really high level bodyguard is an art. I've heard of knife sharpeners being considered an art.
Oh wow!
So all sorts of, it can be very broad. If you can make an argument that it's art, it's worth making, because the O-1 is a great visa, and it's easier to get if you can find something artistic in what you do.
So is it something that I apply by myself, or does someone has to do it for me?
You can't self-petition for the O-1. So
you cannot?
Have, you cannot.
Okay,
no.
Okay.
You have to have a company petitioning for you who wants to use your services in the area that you have extraordinary ability in. So if you have extraordinary ability in the arts, but the petitioning company wants to use you for your business services, that won't work. It has to be in the area that you are.
And it could be my own company as well?
It can, yeah.
Okay.
You can't self-petition yourself, but if you do set up a legal entity and it's going to be a functioning company, then that company can petition for you. And that's something that's fairly common for entrepreneurs to do. Another thing that's great about the O-1 is that there's no prevailing wage requirement. So it's never good to try and set the wage too low if you don't have a really great explanation of why the wage needs to be low, because it'll throw doubt onto how extraordinary you are if you're willing to work for peanuts. But in the case of an entrepreneur who's been successful elsewhere and who's coming here to start up another business that will presumably be successful, and he has a good explanation of why, you know, it's typical in the industry for founders not to take a large salary in the beginning while they're seeking out funding, things like that, then that's a good explanation. But
so this is like unlike H-1B, where there is a prevailing wage requirement.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. And how long can we get this visa for? O-1 visa?
Initially for 3 years, and then after that you can renew in 1 year increments indefinitely, but you have to continue to meet the O-1 standard. So you have to continue to be extraordinary for the entire time. It's not enough to show that you did extraordinary things 5 years ago. You have to show that you are continuing to meet the extraordinary standard. So
I see. So you have to keep up your extraordinary standards. So
yes.
I have to be a great interviewer.
Yes.
At all times.
Yes.
Okay.
At times that you're on the O-1.
Got it. And one of the things that we are later going to discuss is the transition from O-1, right? Do you want to quickly talk about why someone might not indefinitely extend their O-1? What are the other options?
Well, if you qualify for an O-1, then that's a good indication that you probably are also going to qualify for an EB-1 green card. So, you know, if you've filed the O-1 petition, you've qualified. If your intent is to stay here indefinitely, then you might as well go ahead and try the O-1 green card. It's basically the same requirements, almost exactly the same requirements for the EB-1 green card as the O-1. It's for people of extraordinary ability. The differences are with the EB-1 green card, obviously it's permanent. You get a green card. So the standard is a little bit higher because the reward is higher. You can self-petition for an EB-1 green card. So that might be another reason if you're confident that you can meet the standard, you might want to do an EB-1 first if you don't have a petitioning organization who can petition for you. An EB-1 person of extraordinary ability.
So after I get my O-1, I can still self-petition for EB-1?
You could, yeah.
Okay.
You have to prove to them that you're going to continue to work in your field of extraordinary ability after you get your EB1. So you need to have some proof of that, contracts with other companies for work that you're going to do, letters from people who are going to be using your service in your field of extraordinary ability, things like that. But you can actually file the petition yourself.
Okay. The next one I have is the last one in the non-immigrant visa category, which is E2. This is one visa I don't know anything about. So
E2 is basically the only non-immigrant visa that's built specifically for entrepreneurs. It is an investment visa. That the big downside of the E2 is that it's only available to certain nationalities. And India, Brazil, and China are not on the list. So that's probably why you don't know much about it, because
yeah.
a lot of entrepreneurs are from those three countries.
Yes.
But if you are from a country that's on the list, and you can find the list by Googling e-visa countries, it'll come up Department of State.
So is the E2 visa valid for, is the same list as the visa waiver program?
No, it is a different list. It is the E2 program is a treaty-based program, so it's only available to nationalities that have specific treaties of trade and commerce with the U.S.
I see.
So that list is on the Department of State website. There are a lot of countries there, just not the big three.
Okay.
So the rules are that company needs to be at least 50% owned by a person of the treaty country nationality. So for instance, Australia is a treaty company. So if you are an Australian entrepreneur and you want to use the E2 to start your company and get your visa, you need to own at least 50% of that company. And for E2 purposes, anyone with a green card or with dual US nationality is not considered a citizen of the treaty country. So if you are Australian, but you have a green card in the U.S. and you can't use your Australian nationality to have your company count as Australian.
But why would I want to do that if I already have a green card? I wouldn't need an E2 anyway, right?
Well, you might want to do it because you can also, if the company is an E2 company, you can also get E2 visas for your employees.
Oh, it counts for all the employees of the company. Mm. You don't have to be the founder.
Right. So it's a different category within the E2, but it's available for the principal investor who's putting the money in and running the company. And it's also available for the investor's employees of the same nationality.
Okay. So if I have the same nationality, so can I go work for someone with an E2 company as an Indian?
No, because India is not a treaty country.
Okay. So I have to be also an Australian, even though it's based on my employer who owns 50% is from Australia, and I have to be from a treaty country as well as an employee.
You have to be Australian in that situation. You have to be from the
same country. I see, got it.
Of the E2 company's nationality.
Okay, I guess it's meant for like a group or teams of people coming from another country to set up their company in the US. Is that the idea of it?
It doesn't have to be a team. You can hire someone fresh who you've never worked with, who's Australian or British or whatever the treaty company is. It's more for facilitating trade and investment between this list of countries.
Okay. So you said 50% owned, right? So does the 50% must amount to something?
No, it doesn't have to be valued at any specific amount. It just, in order to have a company be able to be the basis for E2 visas, it has to be at least 50% owned by people of that nationality. So the most common scenario that I see this in my practice is a founder is of this nationality and wants to establish his company in the US, and the E2 is a way better option than the H1B, just because you can do it at any time of the year and you don't have to worry about employee employment employee-employer relationship. For the E2, you actually have to show that as the principal investor, you are coming to the U.S. to run the company, basically, that you're going to be in control of the company, which is obviously what most founders want to do anyway. So yeah. It works out well. The trick is that you have to invest your own money in the E2 business to qualify as a principal investor. There's no set amount that you have to invest, but it has to be your own. So, and you have to prove to the government where that it was your own and that you got it from a legal source. So you can get it from gifts from friends or family members. You know, your parents can give you $30,000 for you to invest in your company, but they have to give it to you. Outright, make a gift to you before you then put it in the company.
Some of the talks I've heard earlier about immigration and for startups talk about extensive ways on how to make business plans so that USCIS likes them, right? So mm-hmm. You said this is the kind of visa for specifically for startups. So is this the one that they're talking about, I'm guessing?
The business plan is really important for the E2 visa.
Yeah.
Because you need to, one of the requirements of the E2 visa is that you show the business is not a marginal business. And to show a business is not a marginal business, you have to show that it either is right now or will in the near future be supporting more than just you or your family. And the way you typically do this is by showing that you're going to hire people in the U.S. to work for you. So in an E2 business plan, I always like to see a lot of detail about the timeline for when you're going to start hiring employees, what those employees are going to do exactly, how much they're going to get paid. And then, of course, you have to have all of the, you know, the financial models to back up the claim that you're going to be able to hire and pay people. So yes, it is really important to have a solid business plan. And there are companies out there that specialize in business plans for immigration and who know exactly what needs to be in them. But you can also have your immigration attorney review. You know, obviously, as an attorney, I'm not a business plan writer. I can't review, you know, the business plan for content, but I can look at one and know if it has the sections that we need it to have for immigration purposes.
I see. Got it. And one of the things that we didn't talk about much is what if I have a family, right? Mm-hmm. I am coming to the U.S. with someone, right? Like maybe we can go back really quick and tell which one lets you do that. But how about E2?
E2 is good because your spouse can work. The spouse will have to apply for work authorization, but they are allowed to apply for work authorization.
Okay.
And that's only the case for the E2 and the L, the L1 visa that we've talked about. The
O1 visa, the H1, B1, and mm-hmm. OPT, the spouse cannot work.
Right.
I see. But in L and E2, by default, the spouse can work.
Yes. Well, not by default. The spouse has to put in an application.
I see. Okay.
And apply for a work authorization card.
Is it both L1A and L1B?
Yes.
Okay, so we discussed 7 visa classes so far, and that is the last of the non-immigrant visas. And the next one I have is the immigrant visas. And the first one is EB1. We already talked about the extraordinary ability portion of it. What is the other way to apply for EB1 visa?
So there are two other ways. The second is for outstanding researchers, professors. So I don't see a whole lot of that in my work with startups. The third is for multinational executives or managers. So this basically feeds directly from the L1A that we talked about earlier. A lot of the requirements are the same. There are a few additional requirements, but a lot of people will come over on an L1A. And then instead of extending at the end, they will end up applying for an EB1C green card for multinational managers. And it is a good green card option because it allows you to bypass the perm process, which is just this dreaded, horrible process that some other green card categories have to go through with Department of Labor to prove to Department of Labor that you recruited for this position and there aren't any U.S. workers available to fill the position. For this one, you don't have to do that because you have special, you know, as an intra-company multinational manager, obviously that's not something that can be filled just by someone coming in off the street. So they let you skip the perm process.
Yeah. I just realized we jumped right into the EB1. Do you want to quickly tell the difference between non-immigrant and immigrant visas?
Sure. So a non-immigrant visa is temporary. You're going to have to, you know, each visa has a different period of authorization, as we talked about, but it's going to end. Every time you come in on a non-immigrant visa, you have a defined cutoff point, whether that's a specific date, as in the case of the work-based visas, or if you're a student, your status ends when your study ends. The green cards are, by definition, permanent. You're applying for lawful permanent residence. So once you get it, you have it for the rest of your life, unless you do something to lose it.
Yeah, that's a good distinction to make. So the next one is EB2. What is EB2?
So EB2 is another type of green card. There are two ways to qualify for an EB2. You can show that you either have an advanced degree in the area that you're working in, or that you have exceptional ability in the area that you're working in. So EB2 can be used as just a normal green card route. You know, you are hiring an employee, they have an advanced degree, so you go through the perm process, and then you file an I-140 for them in the EB2 category. But more relevant to entrepreneurs is the national interest waiver that's available with the EB2 green card. That allows you to skip the perm process, which is great for entrepreneurs because if you own even a small fraction of the company, you're probably not going to make it through the perm process because if you're the owner of the company, you can't, a Department of Labor takes the position that there's no way to credibly claim that you were going to offer your job to a U.S. worker if you are the owner of the company. So perm is pretty much dead in the water for owners. So that's why things like EB1A, EB1C, things that don't require perm are what founders need. So with this, you get to skip perm if you can prove that you either have an advanced degree or exceptional ability, and it's in the national interest that the government grants you a green card so you can stay here and continue to develop your business.
Okay, so how do I qualify for this national interest waiver?
So you have to show three basic things. You have to show that the area that you're working in is a field of intrinsic merit. Pretty much everything qualifies for that in one way or another. So that's not a real hurdle. The second thing you have to prove is that your work is of benefit to the nation as a whole, not just locally, but what you're doing is benefiting the country on a nationwide level. And third, the hardest thing to prove is that you have to give them an explanation of why perm should be waived, why you shouldn't have to try and offer your job to U.S. workers and go through the process of proving that there's just no one else available who can, who's qualified to do your job and who's willing to do your job. So normally you do this by arguing that you already have and will continue to contribute to the economy, to your field, at a level that's way above a minimally qualified worker. Because what perm is designed to do is to find a minimally qualified worker who's willing to take your job. And we're saying that you're competing on a completely different level. What you're contributing is so much more valuable than what a minimally qualified worker could contribute that it's just irrelevant whether one is available to fill your position or not. So that's the national interest waiver. So if you're an entrepreneur and you've got a track record of starting successful businesses and employing people, then you can try for the national interest waiver.
And it could that successful streak be outside the U.S.?
Yes, it could. Mm-hmm. You're showing that you're going to come here and do the same thing here that you've done in other countries and create these jobs. And
Is there any other way to get into this EB1 for an entrepreneur apart from national interest waiver?
For the, well, national interest waiver is only available in the EB2 category.
Sorry, EB2, that's what I meant.
You can get an EB2, a normal EB2 by going through the PERM process. But if you have an ownership interest in the company that's petitioning you, you're probably not going to make it through the PERM process. So you need the national interest waiver to get an EB2 if you're a part owner of the company.
Okay. Okay, and what does exceptional ability has to do with the EB2?
Well, that is, as to qualify for an EB2, you have to show either that you have an advanced degree or that you have exceptional ability in your field.
Okay, so this is not for national interest waiver. This is just for qualifying for EB2 in itself.
Right.
I see.
In itself. And then to skip the PERM part of the EB2, that's where you have to show that you qualify for the national interest waiver.
Understood. So what is the exceptional ability that you need to prove?
Well, exceptional ability used to be an easier standard to meet than the extraordinary ability required for the EB1. Mm-hmm. So theoretically, exceptional ability means that you will really stand out in your field, but maybe not quite at the very top like the EB1 folks are. But recently, because of some changes in the interpretation of the law, for all practical purposes, it's a much harder bar. It's a very hard bar to meet. There are a list of ways that you can qualify for the exceptional ability criteria that appears to be easier to meet than the list for the extraordinary ability criteria. But it's not something that you should go into lightly. You really do need to have an excellent track record to qualify for.
Okay. Okay. So I'll leave all the details that you mentioned here in the show notes as well. Okay. Let's move on to the last one that we have on the list, EB5.
So EB5. EB5 is the big investor visa. Right now, you either invest $500,000 in a targeted employment area, so that would be something like a rural area or an area of low employment, or you invest $1 million in anywhere. Those amounts it's likely legislation is pending right now regarding those amounts and other aspects of the EB-5 program too. The whole program is kind of in flux right now, but it's likely that the minimum investment amounts are going to be raised. So the minimum probably in the near future, or not probably, but it's very possible in the near future, it'll be $800,000 instead of $500,000. But the way the law stands right now, if you invest $500,000 in a business in a targeted employment area, and then you show that you are going to be actively involved in the business managing it, you can apply for an EB-5. You can put an EB-5 petition in. It's initially granted for 2 years. So you've got 2 years to develop the business, to finalize your investment, and to create the 10 jobs that you're required to create to qualify for a permanent EB-5. And at the end of the 2 years, you apply to remove conditions, and USCIS will look at the development of your company, make sure that things are on track and that you are creating the jobs and that you have made the full investment that you're required to make. And if you have, then you will get a permanent green card.
I see. The biggest catch here I would see is having the $1 million in the bank.
Right. That's a true catch. And it has to be your own money. So if you get, you know, angel funding, VC funding,
that doesn't
$2 million doesn't count at all. It has to be yours. And they are very rigorous about, you have to prove where you got that money. It's a very, very...
I have a friend who applied for this visa, and he told me that they went all the way back to 1980s to figure out the roots of the money.
Yeah. very typical story for an EB fund. That's the worst part of the process, is trying to figure out where the money, trying to go back far enough to satisfy them about where the money came from.
Mm-hmm. Good. So I think we covered all the visa classes, and I'll link to all of this notes in, and the interview at breakingtheborders.com/visa, V-I-S-A. I have a question. So what is the best place for people to connect with you online?
On my website, startupimmigrationattorney.com. You can send me a message through there. You can book an appointment with me online or on Skype or over the phone. And I also, I answer a lot of questions on Quora, so you can find me on Quora as well. But
how can we find you on Quora? I'm not a Quora user. Oh, okay.
Yeah, Sarah Korsanch.
Sorry.
Lots of my clients are in Quora. That's.
I see.
But there's a, yeah. So, but through my website is the best way.
Okay. And if someone wants to learn more about different classes by themselves, is there some resource out there that can help them find more information?
There are lots of resources of varying quality. There's a lot of misinformation about different visa classes out there. Mm-hmm. I have a blog that has good information on it. Mm-hmm. And I know some other attorneys have good blogs too.
Can you mention one that you respect? I will link to your blog for sure. But apart from that, is there any other blog that
there you is? There's a very well respected attorney here in New York called Cyrus Mehta. Mm-hmm. He has a really extensive blog as well.
Okay. Cyrus Mehta. Mm-hmm. I will link to his blog as well. I'll get the information for you. Sarah, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing all the knowledge.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for tuning in. To get updates on latest episodes, make sure you subscribe with your email by going over to breakingtheborders.com. If you know anyone good as a guest, shoot me an email. I will reach out to the guest, get hold of them, and ask them all the questions that you have. My email is rohit@breakingtheborders.com. Thanks again and have an amazing day.